Good morning. Let me add my welcome to you all. It's a pleasure to have you with us at the International Church of Bishkek. And if you're just joining us for the first time today, or you haven't been here for a little while, we are in a journey through the book of Hebrews. And today we come to a great chapter of Hebrews chapter 12. So many of these chapters of Hebrews are rich and full, and we're trying to take rather large chunks at one time, so we're really trying to get the big picture of it rather than go deep into every word. But we do trust for the Lord to be our teacher today as we come to this amazing chapter of the Bible, Hebrews chapter 12. I have a question for you as we start. One click there. So, what we have on the screen before us is a tree. Now, is this a big tree or a small tree? Put up your hand if you think it's a big tree. Okay. Put up your hand if you think it's a small tree. Okay. Most of you are not very decisive, but that's okay. 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 Now, is this a big tree or a little tree? How many think it's a big tree?
Which one?
The first one, the original tree. How many say it's a small tree? Okay. Not very many. Okay. Now, the same tree. Is this a big tree or is it a little tree? What do we call this? We could describe it in a number of different ways, but ultimately it's a matter of perspective, isn't it? It's a question of perspective. When we view something in isolation without its context, we're not sure what to think exactly. But somehow we can look at the same tree in a larger context and we can look at it in a very different way. I want to suggest to you that what Hebrews 12 is doing for us as we come to this great chapter and as we try to pick up the flow of the book of Hebrews as he's been writing to us, what the writer, what the preacher is doing for us is he's wanting to help us to persevere in our faith. He's wanting to help us to not turn away from following Jesus. We remember that the preacher here is writing this letter probably to believers in the city of Rome in the first century. And in the first century in Rome, it was very difficult to follow Jesus. It was a very difficult life for these people. There was discrimination at work. Often they would lose their jobs because they claimed to be followers of Jesus. Often they would be rejected by their family because they chose to be followers of Jesus. Often they were ridiculed by society because they had chosen to be followers of Jesus. And it was a very difficult life for these people. And what seems to be happening as we understand from the flow of the text of the book of Hebrews, what seems to be happening is that some of these believers were just being crushed under the weight of these difficulties. And they were thinking, is it really worth it to follow Jesus? Perhaps they were having doubts. Is the story really true or not? And what the preacher is doing through the whole of the book of Hebrews is challenging them. Yes, the story is true. Yes, Jesus really is the one who came from God, who became one of us. He really is the King of all creation who came down and came close to us, who became our high priest. Not only he became our high priest, but he became our sacrifice. And the sacrifice who offered himself so that we could have life. All of this stuff really is true. And what the preacher is doing as he's moving through the book is he's saying, hang in there, persevere, don't throw away this faith that you have in Jesus. It's a trustworthy story, is what he's trying to say to us. I wonder if you've ever felt the pressure of difficulties of life, the pressure of circumstances, the pressure of loss, of grief, of opposition, of difficulties of various kinds. Perhaps this is a description of your life even right now. September the 24th, 2009, was one of the most difficult days of my life. My two daughters and I stood beside the bed of my first wife, Barb, as she passed away from this life into the next life. It was one of the most difficult days of my life. In the days and the weeks that followed Barb's death, I experienced more intense feelings of grief and loneliness and loss than I had ever experienced in my life before. I was pastoring a church at the time. I stepped away from that. I couldn't just keep going. And so I stepped away. I took another job just to keep my hands busy. But in that season, I can say that my grieving consumed my life. Really what was defined me in that season. And what I needed most, what I knew I needed most at that time, and I thank God that there were such people around me. What I needed in that time was to have close friends and trusted advisors to help me gain perspective. Not to tell me I shouldn't feel what I'm feeling, but to help me to take that grief, that story of grief, which was so real and so close to me, and to put it in a larger story, to put it in a bigger context. This is what I believe that the writer of Hebrews is calling us to do. He's saying, no matter how difficult life is right now, step back and take a look at the larger picture. There's a different perspective. It doesn't diminish feelings. It doesn't diminish grief. But what it does is it puts it in a bigger perspective. As we come to Hebrews chapter 12, we're getting close to the end of the book. Chapter 13, next week, will be our final lesson in the book of Hebrews. And it's like he's building this crescendo, and there's more sense of urgency as he's calling the readers to lift their eyes from their immediate circumstance and to look at Jesus, to look at this larger picture of the story of salvation. In particular, I want us to look at chapter 12 and see four perspectives that the writer gives us. First, he says, pick up your eyes from your immediate circumstances and look back. Look back at this great cloud of witnesses. Then he also says, look forward. Look forward because Jesus went ahead of you. So that's the first perspective in verses 1 to 3. In verses 4 to 13, he says, okay, look around. Look around at those difficulties that you're experiencing, but look at them through some different eyes in verses 3 to 13. And then in verses 14 to 17, he says, okay, look inside. Look in your heart. Where is your heart in the midst of this circumstance? And then in verses 18 to the end of the chapter, there's this great section of Hebrews chapter 12 where he says, step back and look at the big picture of what God has done in giving us this new covenant relationship through Jesus' blood. And it's an amazingly powerful description at the end of the chapter. So let's look briefly at each one of these. First is look back in verses 1 to 3 and look ahead. So we're called in these first three verses to lift our eyes from our troubles and to look back. Look back at what? Well, last week we had the privilege to look at Hebrews chapter 11. And what did we find in Hebrews chapter 11? There was a long list of names in chapter 11. What were the characteristics of these people in Hebrews chapter 11? There were some common characteristics between all of them. All of them were from the Old Testament section of the Bible. One characteristic: none of them were perfect. All of them sinned. All of them fell short of God's standard of holiness. Some of them fell severely and sinned these great, big, huge moral sins. They were not perfect. They were also people who suffered. Some of them suffered more than others. The latter part of the chapter says, well, there were many more that I'm not going to name. Some of them were sawn in two. Some of them were hung on a cross. Some of them died for their sins, died for their service of God. They suffered even at the cost of their lives. But there's another common characteristic that puts them in that chapter. What's that characteristic? All of them had faith. What is faith? Faith is believing. Faith is really believing that what God said he will do. Faith is really believing that God is, in the Old Testament context, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God who came close to us through the covenant, the God who wants to redeem us and give us life. They had faith even in the midst of opposition. Romans describes Abraham as the one who, against all hope, Abraham believed. Right? When everything looked the opposite, yet these people had faith and trust in the living God. These people now become what the preacher calls a cloud of witnesses. We look back to them. Why? In order to gain courage from their faith to apply it to our context. And that's what he says. I would like us to read these first three verses together. They're on three slides. So please join with me as we say these words together. Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of our faith. For the joy set before him, he endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinners, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. You get the sense of what the writer's doing here? He's saying, look back. Look at these people who stood in faith. And then he's saying, fix your eyes on Jesus. That's looking ahead. There's some actions that come along with looking in this perspective. And the action is described as this: throw off. It's a pretty strong word. It's like, get rid of. Don't let it exist in your life. As you look back at these heroes of faith, look at your life and throw off what? Throw off two things. First, everything that hinders. Secondly, the sin that so easily entangles. I believe that this first phrase is included because the preacher knows that there's some things that come into our lives that are not necessarily sin in themselves, but they can hinder us from really believing in Jesus. They can hinder us from really being wholehearted followers of Jesus. What kind of things are these? Maybe hobbies. Hobbies are great things. It's good to have a hobby. It's good to have something that we really like to do. But if that hobby consumes me to the point of distracting me from really believing in what Jesus did for me, then that hobby is taking me away from God. It's hindering me. And so the preacher tells us, throw away everything that hinders. Maybe it's sports. Nothing wrong with sports. But sometimes we can become so consumed, either as a fan of a sport or a participant in a sport, that it can really draw our attention away from God. So we have to be careful. What are those things that are hindering me from really being a wholehearted follower of Jesus? Maybe it's relationships. We need to examine the relationships that we have. And it could be that we're involved in an unhealthy relationship, a relationship that is drawing my attention away from God instead of drawing me towards God. The preacher says, throw away those things that hinder. And then we have this phrase, that the sin that so easily entangles. The picture that the preacher is painting for us here is a picture of running. He's going to say in a moment, run with endurance. It's not a 100-meter dash. This is a marathon that he's talking about, running with endurance. So what is it that gets caught up in my feet that doesn't allow me to run? Get rid of it. Whatever kind of sin that might be. We were walking in the mountains this week. Saw a horse in the distance, and I was carrying one of our friend's kids on my shoulder, and he was saying, "Well, look, horse, horse." And as we got closer, we realized, you know, why he was by himself, why he wasn't moving very much. Well, his front feet were tied together. He was hobbled. You can't run when you're hobbled. And sometimes there are sins that can come into our lives that hobble us. They don't allow us to run the race with endurance and perseverance. It's often in these times of struggle, often in these times of grieving, when life is dark and I'm feeling depressed about something or I'm feeling angry about something, it's often in those spaces, those mindsets, where we can allow little sins to exist, right? We can excuse ourselves a little freedom. And so I can say to myself, I convince myself, I have the right to get angry at my spouse. I have the right to get angry at my children. And we can allow that evil anger, that harmful anger to exist in my life. Also in these times of darkness and struggle, I believe that the temptation to use my sexuality in a way that's not according to the plan of God grows. That temptation grows. In the season when I was learning to live life alone after 27 years of marriage, I found myself coming to a point where I knew that I had to disconnect the cable television from my house. Because I knew there was too much temptation for me there to watch things on TV that were not good for me. So we have to make these choices. The preacher is urgently saying to us, throw away, get rid of the sin that entangles your feet so that you cannot really run with perseverance the race that is marked out for us. And that's the next action that we have, this sense of running with perseverance, endurance. This is the marathon. It's very interesting that the preacher says, run with perseverance, the race that is marked out for us. God knows the path of our lives. It's an amazing comfort right in the middle of these words, I believe. Job is one of these great examples in the Old Testament of someone who suffered and yet held firm in his faith. Job at one point says this in Job 23 and verse 10. He says this, he that is God, God knows the way that I take. And when he has tested me, I will come forth as gold. So God knows the way I take. God knows the path of your life too. And what he's calling us to do is to run the race that he has marked out for us. And so we look back, we take courage from these heroes of faith, but we look forward, and what's the next phrase? Fixing our eyes on Jesus, who is the pioneer and perfecter of our faith. This is the part of looking forward. In another place in Hebrews, we saw Jesus described as our forerunner. He's the one who goes ahead. And in this case, we see him going ahead as our example in suffering. So it says, Who is this Jesus? He is the pioneer. Or other words to say the same thing, he's the author. He's the founder. He's the one who started this whole faith. He's the one who came to make it possible. So he's the one who begins this faith. But he's also the perfecter. He's the completer, the finisher, the one who completes it through his own suffering and makes it perfect. And what does he do? He sets us an example of joy in suffering. Who for the joy set before him, what was Jesus doing? He was putting his suffering in the bigger perspective, right? He was taking this grief that he was feeling. You remember when he was in the garden just before he went to the cross, was he feeling the pain of that suffering? He absolutely was. God, if it's possible, take this away from me. Let's do it another way. I don't want to go through with this. But for the joy set before him, he endured the cross, suffered the shame, and he went through with the plan of salvation. The whole weight, the sin, the weight of the sin of the whole world was crushed upon him. And so the preacher says, consider him. Look to Jesus as the example. So in those times when we're feeling the press of opposition and struggle and grieving and pain, look to Jesus. He went through it. For the joy set before him, he endured it. And so these actions are designed to help us bring perspective. Perspective by looking back at these witnesses. Perspective by fixing our eyes on Jesus. It's a strong term. It's like we look back, we take courage, but what we do is we fix our eyes on Jesus. Consider, carefully consider him so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. Let's move to the next section. The next perspective is to look around. in verses 4 through 13. And what I believe the preacher is doing here, having fixed their eyes on Jesus, he says, okay, now look at the troubles that you have, but look at them from a different perspective. If you have your Bible open to chapter 12, please read along with me. I'll just read chapter 12 and verses 4 through 13. Listen carefully to the words. He says, in your struggle against sin, you have not resisted to the point of shedding your blood. And have you completely forgotten this word of encouragement that addresses you as a father addresses his son? It says, and then the preacher quotes from Proverbs. This is what he says in Proverbs. My son, do not make light of the Lord's discipline. Do not lose heart when he rebukes you. Because the Lord disciplines the one that he loves, and he chastens everyone he accepts as a son. So the preacher continues. Endure hardship as discipline. God is treating you as his children. For what children are not disciplined by their father? If you are not disciplined, and everyone undergoes discipline, then you are not legitimate, not true sons and daughters at all. Moreover, we have all had human fathers who disciplined us, and we respected them for it. How much more should we submit to the Father of spirits and live? They disciplined us for a little while as they thought best, but God disciplines us for our good in order that we may share in his holiness. No discipline seems pleasant at the time, but painful. Later on, however, it produces a harvest of righteousness and peace for those who have been trained by it. Therefore, strengthen your feeble arms and your weak knees. Make level paths for your feet, so that the lame may not be disabled, but rather healed. What is the key principle that he's saying here? As we look at the difficulties and the circumstances of our lives, what's the key principle? Key principle is this: endure hardship as discipline, because God is treating you as his children. This paragraph, the subject of this paragraph, the subject which this paragraph opens up for us, is very deep and very wide and very large, and we're not going to go deeply into the problem of suffering in the few minutes that we have together. Why do bad things happen to good people? It's a very complex question. Scripture speaks much to it. What we want to try to do is capture the heart of this paragraph. What I will not do in these next few minutes is to try to offer a simple answer to the question of why we suffer. I don't think this particular paragraph addresses the question. If we ask the question of why we suffer, the answer is very complicated. Sometimes we suffer directly because of our sin, but not always. Sometimes we suffer directly because somebody else sins, but not always. In the Bible and in our lives, we find many examples of people suffering, not because of anyone's sin in particular, but in order that God might do his work in us. We can think of examples like John 9, for example, with the blind man. What this paragraph in Hebrews 12, I believe, is pointing us to is not so much the why question, but for what purpose? For what purpose do these struggles and trials come into our lives? And there are two phrases that stand out strongly to me in this passage. The first phrase is in verse 10. Can we read this one? This first one, verse 10 in the brown. It says, God disciplines us for our good in order that we may share in his holiness. God is working in our lives. And what the preacher wants to tell us is that some way, in some mysterious way that we can't always figure out, but in some way that the struggles and the trials and the pain and the grieving that comes into our lives, it shapes us. And what God is in the business of doing is shaping us into the image of Jesus. He's shaping us into being people of holiness. Let's read verse 11 together. No discipline seems pleasant at the time, but painful. Later on, however, it produces a harvest of righteousness and peace for those who have been trained by it. And so somehow in the mystery of life, we know that these difficulties of life shape us, form us. I know that I have learned things in the dark seasons of my life that I would never learn if I hadn't gone through those things. So somehow God shapes us, forms us into people of holiness. Once again, we come back to these same words of Job. He knows the way I take, Job said. God knows that I've lost my whole family, everything I own. All my friends are accusing me. But He, God, knows the way I take. And Job makes this amazing statement. When I am tried, when He has tested me, I will come forth as gold. It's the picture of purifying gold. How does gold get purified? It goes through fire. Fire burns up all the dross and the impurities. And what's left is pure gold. So the whole idea in this principle is that God is a loving Father. God is a Father who loves you. And these things that happen in our lives, He desires that they would shape us to become more holy, shape us to become more aware of our dependence on Him, shape us and mold us into the likeness of Jesus. There's so much more in there, but we need to look on to the next section, chapter 12, verses 14 to 17. Here, after looking back, looking forward, after looking around again at the struggles of our lives through that perspective, He says, okay, look inside your heart. Check your hearts. Let me read these verses to you, 14 to 17. Make every effort to live at peace with everyone and to be holy. Without holiness, no one will see the Lord. See to it that no one falls short of the grace of God and that no bitter root grows up to cause trouble and defile many. See that no one is sexually immoral or is godless like Esau, who for a single meal sold his inheritance rights as the oldest son. Afterward, as you know, when he wanted to inherit this blessing, he was rejected. Even though he sought the blessing with tears, he could not change what he had done. And so I believe in this paragraph is a challenge to look into our hearts and say, are we seeking holiness in our hearts? Are we making choices that lead to holiness? There's this strong language again that we saw earlier. Before it was throw off. Now it's make every effort and see to it. What are the things that we're to make every effort for and to see happen in our lives? Well, he says live in peace. Live in peace with everyone. So we're to check our hearts as we understand and as we seek to live in relationship with each other. How do we relate to each other? Are we living at peace with the people around us? Are we being holy? Set apart for the purposes of God. That's what holiness means. He says, don't let roots of bitterness grow up in your hearts. If we don't fix relationships, bitterness can easily grow. He says, avoid sexual immorality. Again, it's the choices we make day by day. Make every effort. See to it. God has done this work. God has given you the free gift of salvation, but see to it that you live it out, is what he seems to be saying. Check your heart. Don't be godless. Don't make decisions in your life without reference to the living God who saved you. Well, then we come to this great big picture in verses 18 through 29, where I believe what the preacher is doing, he says, okay, you've looked back, you've looked forward, you've looked around, you've looked in your heart. Now step back and remind yourself of the big picture of what God has done. Remind yourself in particular of the privilege of the new covenant. I would like to read some of these verses. I won't read all of them. I'll read verses 18 down to 24. As I read these verses, listen for the two pictures that the writer is painting a picture for us here. He's talking about the old covenant, and he's painting a picture of a mountain that the old covenant is described as. He's painting a picture of another mountain that is the new covenant. Listen for the language of contrast, the language of comparison. Verse 18, you have not come to a mountain that can be touched and that is burning with fire, to darkness, to gloom and storm, to a trumpet blast, or to such a voice speaking words that those who heard it begged that no further word be spoken to them, because they could not bear what was commanded. If even an animal touches the mountain, it must be stoned to death. The sight was so terrifying that Moses said, "I am trembling with fear." Here's the second picture. "But you haven't come to that mountain, you've come to this mountain," the preacher says. "You have come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem. You have come to thousands upon thousands of angels in joyful assembly, to the church of the firstborn, whose names are written in heaven. You have come to God, the judge of all, to the spirits of the righteous made perfect, and to Jesus. To Jesus, who is the mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood that speaks a better word than the blood of Abel." So what's the key principle here? The key principle in these two mountains, it's a contrast. We won't go into the details of the description of each of these mountains, but in the first Old Covenant description, what is the preacher describing? He's describing that time when Israel had been saved out of Egypt, they'd been rescued out of Egypt, and God brought them to Mount Sinai, and there God gave them the law. You remember there was thunder and lightning, the mountain was shaking. This is what is being described here. What is the chief characteristic of this description that the preacher gives here? The chief characteristic is fear. Why is it fear? Because what was going on in this old covenant relationship is that a holy God was coming close to a sinful people. And the problem is that this problem of sin in these people had not been fully dealt with. And so what happens when sin comes into the presence of God, a holy God, this God who later the preacher will say, this God who is a consuming fire, what happens to that sin? It burns up. And so there's this fear, because anyone stepping over the line inadvertently in their sinfulness into the presence of holy God would be burned up. And even Moses, this one who spoke to God face to face, said in this awesome situation, he said, "Even I was trembling with fear." But what's the chief characteristic of the new covenant? This same holy God who is a consuming fire comes close to us who are also sinful people. What's the difference? Jesus died. Jesus' blood paid for my sin. Jesus' blood opened a way so that I can come into the very presence of God. And so we don't come to this mountain of fear. We come to this mountain of joy. And this is an amazing picture. As we read the language here of this heavenly Jerusalem, you have come to thousands and thousands of angels in joyful assembly. It's this picture of the whole of creation celebrating what God did through sending Jesus to die on the cross. It's a great celebration of joy. This is the mountain that we come to. This sense of celebrating what God did to open up relationship between us and Him. It's a celebration. It's full of joy. The victory has been won. The language in this text tells us our names are already written in heaven. The battle is won. The victory has been paid for completely. And so there's this sense, this picture on this mountain, this Mount Zion, of great celebration. I wonder whether we celebrate our faith enough. Joy Davidman wrote a little book called Smoke on the Mountain. And in this book, she uses an illustration of what she calls a Martian anthropology. I'm going to use her illustration, but I'm going to modify it a little bit for our international church setting. In this illustration, we have the picture of an alien from Mars who is an anthropology student. And this alien comes to Earth And so we imagine this alien riding his little spaceship, and he comes down to Earth with the task of exploring and researching the religious practices and faith practices of these humanoids, these earthlings, these human people. And so he comes down in his little spacecraft, and he comes down in several places, observes several things about religious practice on the Earth. The first place he comes to is he is hovering over a European football stadium. And as he comes down over this stadium, he's making observations, he's writing notes. Whoa, these people sing. Ole, 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 ole. And they sing with enthusiasm. They're standing up and they're going back and forth. And there's a few people that seem to be very intently chasing this little round thing on the field. They're very dedicated to this task. And when this little thing goes through the end, whoa, everything breaks out into this frenzied celebration. So he makes notes and he says, whoa, these people are very enthusiastic worshipers. And then he goes back up in the atmosphere and he comes down over Brazil, of all places. And he comes down over the beaches of Brazil. And he finds, he observes, there's thousands and thousands of people. They're all going in one direction, toward the beach. And he's watching them and observing them. He's saying, wow, these people are worshiping the sun. And they worship the sun by frolicking with all their might in the waves. And then when they're tired of doing that, they come back and they lather themselves, they anoint themselves with oil. They lie on the beach and they look up. And they don't just do it once, they do it every day. These are very dedicated worshipers. And then he goes back up in his spacecraft and he comes down over, well, I'll pick on Canada this time. And he observes several hundred people coming together in this, dressed very conservatively into this building, and they close the door. And from the outside, he can see that they're singing, but he can hardly hear. Some of them are kind of going like this, but not really singing. And then someone gets up and talks for a very long time. Some people doze off. Some people are obviously thinking about lunch or maybe what's coming up next week. Then they get up and they drink tea and go home. And he makes his observations. He says, yeah, these people maybe aren't so sure about what they believe. It seems like the life has gone out of their belief. Please be careful to hear what I'm trying to say with this illustration and what I'm not trying to say with this illustration. I'm not trying to say that all forms of worship need to be like a European football stadium. They don't all need to be boisterous. But I am saying that our response of worship needs to be wholehearted. If we really believe that this story of Jesus, the fact that Jesus came to die for us, to give us life, if we really believe it's true, then our response ought to be wholehearted. Whatever that happens to look like in your culture and your personality. But it needs to be this wholehearted response of worship. And there's this sense of joy that should fill us as we understand what Jesus did to give us life. You didn't come to this mountain of fear, you came to this mountain of joy. We need to look at the last two verses of this chapter, where there's another principle that comes out very strongly to us here. And that is that it's the same God, but it's a new covenant. This God that we worship is the same God who was the God who came to the mountain in the old covenant. It's the same God. But what we have is a great privilege. Because of what Jesus did. Can we read these verses together? Therefore, since we are receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken, let us be thankful and so worship God acceptably with reverence and awe, for our God is a consuming fire. The preacher wants us to pay attention to the reality of what God has done for us. In the midst of grieving, in the midst of struggle especially, lift up your eyes to look at the bigger context of what God has done for you. And so we look back. We take courage from those heroes of faith. We look ahead by fixing our eyes on Jesus. We look around at the struggles of our lives from a new perspective, and we say, God is doing something in me. I don't understand it all, but God is shaping me through these struggles. We look in and we check our hearts for impurities. We seek to throw them away. We seek to make choices that allow us to follow Jesus wholeheartedly. And then we step back and we look at this big picture. This big picture where we see the privilege of the new covenant. This incredible privilege that we have. Let us celebrate it with all of our hearts. We're going to sing the song 10,000 Reasons, and we could perhaps begin to list 10,000 reasons why our hearts ought to respond to God in this way. But I would encourage us, as we sing this song, let's imagine, because I believe that that's what's happening, let's imagine these thousands and thousands of angels who are joining in joyful assembly with us to worship God because of what Jesus did. And so we sing, bless the Lord, O my soul. Worship His holy name. Sing like never before. O my soul, I will worship your holy name. Would you stand, please, and let us pray as we prepare to sing. Father, as you have taught us through your word, we invite you now to receive worship from our lives. Lord, we know that worship is not just about singing, it's about our whole lives. But we thank you for the gift of music through which we may also worship you. So teach us to give you glory and worship through our lives. Teach us what that looks like tomorrow as we live our lives at work, at school, in our exams, whatever we're doing. Help us to remember the privilege that we have in this new covenant. And help us to offer our lives as an act of worship to you throughout this whole week. May it be for your glory. Amen.